This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some cancers that until recently were considered lethal are now treatable, if not curable. The new smart cancer drugs that are targeted to cancer cells are the subject of the new book, The Cancer Treatment Revolution. My guest is the author, Dr. David G. Nathan, President Emeritus of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Physician-in-Chief Emeritus at Children's Hospital in Boston, and Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at Harvard Medical School. With smart drugs, he says, more patients should be able to live for longer periods with far less toxicity. Dr. Nathan, welcome to Fresh Air. What makes a smart drug smart?
The smart drug is classified as such because it is highly targeted and also targeted to a single pathway that should knock out the cancer cell without damaging normal cells.
So what is the knowledge that we have now of how cancer works that is enabling scientists to create these smart drugs?
Well, that is the amazing development of the past 25 or so years. That is that we've begun to understand what causes cancer. I mean, we have known for 100 years that at least the common cancers that we deal with, like breast and prostate, lung and gastrointestinal tract, all those cancers, which are called epithelial cancers because they line the tubes of the body, arise from a single cell that is very damaged in its DNA. But in the last few years, we've been able to see that what really happens in cancer is that there's either a cataclysmic or a gradual destruction of the chromosomes by mutations that are accumulated. And when that happens, the chromosomes all mash together, and many genes are lost, and some genes are greatly amplified, that is, increased in number, and some of them get enormously activated and put out very different proteins that are highly active. And that produces two kinds of problems. One of them is called an oncogene. That means that the cancer is putting out, that the gene that's damaged is putting out a protein that is highly active or simply putting out much too much of a growth-regulating protein. Either way, signals to the daughter cells of the cancer are to grow from that protein. That protein just shouts to the nucleus, divide, divide, divide. And that's a protein that's got to be stopped. And once we identify it, we can block it. Now,
so,
there's another...
Well,
go ahead.
Before we get to another example, so in this one kind of cancer, you have this damaged gene that produces this protein that you compare in your book to a jangling telephone that doesn't stop and keeps sending continuous signals to cells to divide.
Right. Exactly.
So you've got this protein that's causing cells to multiply, causing cancer cells to multiply. So how do new medicines target that protein?
Okay. So that idea, by the way, when it became clear to a very smart medicinal chemist at Ceba Pharmaceuticals, which became Novartis, made him think, well, if we could pull such a protein up and clone it, make lots of it, and put it into a cell, then we might be able to use that cell as a screen for all of the chemicals in our secret library and see which one of those chemicals blocked the protein. And that's exactly what he did and came up with Gleevec, the drug that was used then in an unusual leukemia. Well, not so unusual. Chronic myelogenous leukemia is not that uncommon. And it worked because it blocked a protein just like that. And it turns out that that leukemia is just totally dependent on that particular protein for its survival. In other words, the cancer cell has selected that protein for its use in order to outgrow everybody else. That's what natural selection is all about. That you're really seeing in cancer evolution, if you will. growth advantage.
And right? One of the great things about a targeted drug, a drug that, for instance, would target this protein, is that, you know, the old chemos, which are still in use, target, correct me if I'm wrong here, target all fast-growing cells, because cancer cells are fast-growing cells. But a lot of healthy cells are fast-growing cells, too. And that's why you lose your hair on a lot of the chemo drugs, and it affects the lining of your stomach, because these are fast-growing cells. I guess that doesn't happen with the smart drugs.
That's correct. If the smart drug is particularly well-targeted to just one gene,
mm-hmm.
it's very likely that the normal cell can get along quite well without that gene, because it has other genes that will do the job. Now, as you make the smart drug broader and broader, capable of interfering with more than exactly one protein, if you will, then you may get more toxicity. But for the most part, these drugs can be very targeted to one protein.
You gave us the example of Gleevec, which targets a protein that is common in a form of leukemia. What is an example of a smart drug that is being used or developed for breast cancer?
Well, the first smart agent, if you will, that was made was an antibody, a big protein, an antibody against a protein made by about 20% of breast cancers, a protein that really drives the tumor and makes it, by the way, extremely aggressive. And that antibody is called Herceptin. Trastuzumab is the generic name. And the development of that by Dennis Slamon in Los Angeles was really the beginning of the cancer treatment revolution. And Herceptin, when it's used up front in these very severe breast cancers, when it's used immediately after surgery and with combination chemotherapy and with anything else we can use, dramatically changes the survival of those patients. I mean, they were very difficult to treat until Herceptin. And so here we have an example of an antibody being used to really tie up the protein. It doesn't block it in the absolute sense of a drug, but it sort of gloms onto the protein and renders it functionless. And it really works. So that was the first agent. Gleevec was then the second, and in a pill form. And not only was Gleevec useful in leukemia, it turns out that there was another disease called gastrointestinal stromal tumor, an intractable bowel tumor that really was impossible to treat with anything. That tumor, it turns out, is totally dependent in its early stages on exactly one protein, and that protein happens to be knocked out by Gleevec. And I can tell you, when you watch this tumor being treated by Gleevec, it's simply amazing. I know of one case treated by George Dimitri at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and this is a very interesting story. There was a patient with a gastrointestinal stromal tumor who had what's called a PET scan to identify the fact that he had hundreds of these tumors in his abdomen. The PET scan was strongly positive, and Dimitri gave a dose of Gleevec to the patient. And then he called up the PET scan office to try to get a repeat scan in a couple of weeks. And the PET scan office was so busy that they couldn't give him a date except the following day. And Dimitri just decided to take it. The following day, that tumor was dead. One dose of Gleevec, showing how much that tumor depended on that particular protein to live.
Now, say you have a kind of cancer that can be targeted with these new smart drugs. Does that mean that the cancer is less likely to come back?
Well, here's the problem. When one is dealing with just one pathway, the cancer cell is very apt to continue to mutate. The cancer cell is injured. Its DNA is in bad shape. So it keeps randomly mutating. And it will mutate in the face of the drug to find another pathway, to open up another pathway, or even to change the protein itself, change its entire its structure so that the drug can no longer get into it. So the facts are, if there are resistant cells already in the cancer cell mix, then by natural selection, again, you're going to kill off all the sensitive cells and leave only the resistant cells. And they will grow up eventually. They may have trouble because there's still drug around, but they will find a way to grow even though the drug is there. And that's the weakness of single-agent treatment with any cancer therapy. You usually need to use more than one pathway.
So does that mean even if you have a cancer that can be targeted with one of the new drugs, you're still going to get chemo and maybe radiation and all that stuff? Yeah.
Right. Or you may need to use another smart drug. In other words, you may need to have a research, a diagnostic system that tells you, well, yes, the cancer cell is using this pathway, pathway number one, most of the time, but it also has a mutation in another pathway, and we got to get that one too. I mean, we know from the history of combination chemotherapy that single agents just don't work. So now we know we have to use combinations, and I think we'll have to, in the end, we will be using combination smart drugs.
My guest is Dr. David G. Nathan, President Emeritus of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and author of the new book, The Cancer Treatment Revolution. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. David G. Nathan, and he's the President Emeritus of the Dana-Farber Institute for Cancer Research and Treatment and Physician-in-Chief Emeritus of the Children's Hospital in Boston. He's written a new book called The Cancer Treatment Revolution, How Smart Drugs and Other Therapies Are Renewing Our Hope and Changing the Face of Medicine. There's a study that was just published a few days ago saying that MRIs are more effective than mammograms in detecting breast cancer. What's your interpretation of that study and how it should be acted on?
Well, I agree that MRIs are more effective, and I mentioned that in the book. But MRIs are a two-edged sword. They pick up very small tumors, or let's put this way, they pick up more small lumps, some of which are tumors. This means an awful lot of unnecessary biopsies are done. And second, even if a very small tumor is detected, that doesn't mean that that very small tumor is ever going to become a clinical cancer. I think we're growing little cancers all the time in our bodies, and then the sniffing proteins that go around and check on abnormalities kill them. So they don't amount to anything. This is certainly true in the prostate, where it's very common to have prostate cancer that just never goes anywhere. And I'm sure that's true of breast cancer as well. So we're going to over-treat a lot of people who never needed to be treated. Now, we have no way of knowing who's who. So wisely, those who are saying use MRIs are saying use it only in very high-risk situations. And that I agree with. If you have a very high-risk woman who, let's say, has a very strong family history or is known to have a gene defect in the family that causes cancer, yes, there you ought to be very aggressive. But I fear that MRI is going to be used by everybody, and that's a huge mistake.
When you say treated, are you talking about removing surgically the little tumors?
Yeah.
Or are you talking about all of a sudden you're on chemo also?
Well, no, you wouldn't get put on chemo because we don't use chemo for very tiny tumors.
Mm-hmm.
But still, this is a very invasive procedure. to operate on someone and take out a lump and maybe give them radiation locally. That just doesn't make sense to me. I think that the mammogram is probably a good compromise. It's also overdiagnosis, but nothing like an MRI.
Let's talk about Elizabeth Edwards. I think everybody assumes that Elizabeth Edwards got the best health care possible. She's a very high profile. The family has enough money to afford the best medical care. So if we proceed with the assumption that she had the best medical care possible, what does it say about where we are now with breast cancer treatment that her cancer returned? I guess maybe you could tell us about the type of cancer that she had and why you think the treatments failed to prevent it from metastasizing.
Well, I'm sure that she got the best treatment, and I know that that best treatment can virtually cure 80% of women with her type of breast cancer. I'm positive that she was in that group from what I've been able to read. So why did it fail? Why does it fail for 20%? And the reason for it is that breast cancer can be driven not only by proteins that shout to the nucleus to divide, but also may be due to lack of proteins that make cancers die. We all have proteins in us that look around at our genes and our DNA and say whether it's in good shape or not. And if it's not in good shape, those proteins tell the cell to die. If we're missing those proteins, then the cells will continue to live, even if we damage them. And I think that's probably what happened to Ms. Edwards. Her cancer cells are missing some important proteins that regulate cell death, and that makes them much tougher to treat.
Now, her cancer is being described as not curable but treatable. What does treatable mean in that context?
Well, it means that she's going to have to receive lifelong chemotherapy, one or two drugs, not a large number of drugs, but one or two drugs that will suppress her cancer cells. It probably will not cure them, that is, eliminate them. But she can go along for a very long time. I mean, breast cancer really has to be seen as kind of a chronic illness, and we have to keep it suppressed. And the patients, and she's absolutely right, she's going to live her life, and she's going to live her life with cancer. She's not going to live her life for cancer. And there's a big difference. We can keep it suppressed. Now, if it mutates again and again and becomes more and more aggressive, that's tougher. But I can tell you, I've seen patients who have relapsed, who have been around for 10 or 15 years, are always going for the next trial, for the next new agent, and they're moving along and they're running their lives.
So with Elizabeth Edwards, when she first was diagnosed with cancer, it was stage 3, and now it's stage 4?
That's right. She was a standard stage 3 patient, had an expectation of a cure rate of 80%, and unfortunately relapsed and is now stage 4. But interestingly, she relapsed, as far as I know, only in bone. And for reasons that are not absolutely clear to me, that has a better prognosis than had she relapsed either in the say the liver. For some reason, when breast cancer cells is found only in bone, the outlook is better.
That leads me to Tony Snow, whose colon cancer metastasized to his liver. Are there drugs that can address a spread to the liver? I know the liver is a really difficult organ to treat.
Yes, there are. Now, and the outlook for stage 4 patients with colon cancer in the last 10 years has definitely improved. In fact, it's doubled. And that's with standard combination chemotherapy, as combinations have been added. I would say that it's more difficult than metastatic, than stage 4 breast cancer, restricted to bone, but it can be done. And basically, the attitude must be, if it can be done, it will be done. That's the only way for Tony Snow or any other similarly afflicted patient to look at it. You must take that view, and in many, many times, you'll be absolutely right. And this man has, and Elizabeth Edwards has, as far as I'm concerned, attitudes about this that I wish any afflicted patient would have. They have the right approach. It's just got to work.
Dr. Nathan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Dr. David G. Nathan is President Emeritus of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. His new book is called The Cancer Treatment Revolution. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.